please find 1 Samuel chapter 9. Please find 1 Samuel chapter 9. As you're doing that, let me give you a brief reminder of where we finished up last time. In chapter 8, it opens with a report that Samuel was getting old, and he had tried to do some nepotism, putting his sons into the place of leadership that he had had. That had not gone well. The sons were apparently corrupt. And it is implied that the elders of the people came to him because of that. There is later in what we will look at today a suggestion that there was another reason for this. But in any event, in chapter 8, it's presented in the context of Samuel's sons being corrupt. The elders came and said, "We don't want your sons to be doing this, and you can't do it anymore. So we want a king." And the phrase that is echoed across that chapter is, "We want a king so that we can be just like everybody else." The whole idea of the nation of Israel was that they would not be just like everybody else, but would instead be a special possession for whom God was the king. God says to Samuel, who protested this and prayed to the Lord about it, God said, "They're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me." Silence about his sons, and there's some evidence a little bit later on that his sons are still doing some kind of functioning. But in any event, chapter 8 ends with God saying to Samuel, "Do as they ask, give them a king." So chapter 9 begins with an introduction to this king. Chapter 9 verse 1 gives you his background. His father was named Kish. It shows you who his ancestry was. It indicates that Kish, Saul's father, was a person of rank. Verse 2 says that Kish had a son named Saul, and it describes him. What's the first thing it says about him? Now, the first hour did not pick up the import of what we're about to talk about. They did not react at all. "I want you to do better. You're younger. You're quicker. You can do this, I know." What's the first thing it says about Saul?
Handsome.
Handsome.
From the outside. Mm-hmm.
Impressive. And what's the third thing it says?
Tall.
Okay. Now, tall and handsome and impressive do not always go together, but sometimes they do. Sometimes they do. As I'll say again, the first hour did not pick up on that thought at all. I was very disappointed. But anyway, there it is. How tall was he? Head and shoulders. Taller than anyone. This means if you go shopping with this person, as long as the racks of goods are not too high, you should have no trouble figuring out where the person is. If you're in a crowd of some kind, you just look, "Oh, there he is." I want you to keep that in mind. If you have read through this, you will know why I'm saying that. Keep that in mind. He should be easy to spot in a crowd. Okay. Mine says in the prime of life, yours says impressive, right? Handsome, impressive, mine says in the prime of life. No one more handsome than he. No one taller than he. He's head and shoulders taller than anyone else. My verse 3 starts strangely. Mine says the word since. Now, they haven't told us anything about donkeys up to this point, but they act as if we're supposed to know something about the donkeys. And they say, "Well, since the donkeys were doing so-and-so, this follows." So, I don't remember exactly how yours reads at that point, probably equally strangely. But in any event, some donkeys are missing. Whose donkeys?
Kish's.
So Saul is sent out to search for the lost donkeys. He takes one of the servants with him, and off they go. And they apparently have a pretty long trip, and they haven't found them. Verse 5 says, when they got to a certain place, this is maybe the fifth or the sixth of the tribe's land that they have been through. Saul says to the servant who was with him, "Let's go back to my father, because he's probably about now going to stop worrying about the donkeys and start worrying about us." There comes a point where if you send out a search party, there comes a point you start to worry less about what they're searching for and worry more about the safety of the search party. That's the implication of this. The servant replies, though, what? "There's a man of God supposed to be in this next town, a man who is held in honor. Everything he says comes true. let's go there then. Maybe he'll be able to show us the way that we should take. Who is this man of God they're speaking of? Almost certainly Samuel. It turns out that's who it is. Verse 7, Saul is bright enough to say, well, we can't go to the man of God to ask him for this without taking him a gift. And they began to pat their pockets, I think. And what did they come up with? What's the gift they're going to offer to the man of God? Quarter of a shekel. Okay? And I think if you use the word quarter, you'll have it pretty close to where that's all they've been able to come up with. They've got a quarter between them. We'll give that to the man of God for him to tell us which way to go. And off they go. Now, I want you to jump down to verse 15. Jump down to verse 15. I'm in chapter 9. First hour got lost two or three times. I'm in chapter 9, verse 15. About the time Saul is making his way towards Samuel, God is having a conversation with Samuel. Verse 15 starts this. He'd given Samuel a revelation the day before. And what was the revelation? Verse 16. About this time tomorrow, I'm going to send you somebody. Where's this person going to be from? The land of Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin. You are to anoint him as prince of my people Israel, and he will save my people from the power of the Philistines. For I have seen the misery of my people, and their cries of anguish have come to me. The Philistines, after Samson, appear to have come back in and have taken things over again, and there's some oppression going on. Okay? Verse 17, when Samuel saw Saul, now how would he have seen him? He's in the town, he sees the guy coming. He sees the guy coming, head and shoulders above everything else. God whispers in his ear, this is the man of whom I told you, he is to govern my people. Verse 18, mine has a very strange verb that leads off this verse. I don't think yours does, so I'll just share this with you. Mine says, Saul accosted Samuel. Yours says approached. Okay? Yeah, very different connotation. Okay? Accosted Samuel in the gateway and said, tell me please where the prophet's house is. And Samuel replies, I'm the prophet, or I'm the seer, S-E-E-R. And they explained to you back up in verse 9 or so, somewhere up in there, they have an explanation of the meaning of that word, seer. I am the seer, I'm the prophet. Go ahead of me up to the high place, you must eat with me today, and tomorrow when I let you go, I will tell you whatever is on your mind. Watch carefully that phrasing. Does that sound odd to your ear? Tomorrow, I will tell you everything that's on your mind. Not tomorrow, you can tell me everything that's on your mind. Tomorrow, I'm going to tell you everything that's on your mind.
All that's in your heart.
All that's in your heart. Yeah. Not sure it really goes that deep when it gets to it, but there it is. And I think what Samuel is saying, you're going to see the power of a prophet. I'm going to know more than you think I ought to know because God's revealed it to me. Okay, I want to pause for a minute with that word accosted. There's a suggestion that the term that's used in the original Hebrew here has a little bit of that piece to it. And I want to just give you a story that will let you have a sense of what could have happened. Some of you know that there's a woman by the name of Ferella, I think her name is, or Ferriella, who was for a long time the medical examiner for the state of Virginia. Patricia Cornwall modeled her principal character in a bunch of her mystery novels after this woman. Very famous. Started the state of Virginia down the road of DNA testing and lots and lots and lots of other things. So far, okay? Okay, this woman was coming to speak at the University of Richmond. They had a room set up with 350 chairs, something like that, and it was pretty full. It was pretty full. I was sitting maybe four rows back on the left-hand side. Alongside of me was a longtime colleague, and in front of us was a young woman who had her purse or her backpack on the chair next to her, and it was the only empty seat in sight. This older woman, a little bit short, a little bit, well, she sort of looked like somebody that might be going to the grocery store. came up, looked at this empty seat, the only one around, and said, "May I sit here?" And the girl says, "No, I'm saving this for my friend." The woman stands there for a moment and said, "I'm really tired. Could I just sit there until your friend comes? And if your friend hasn't come by the time the speaker starts, well, I'll go ahead and get up and leave the place for it." And she says, "Well, I guess so." And she pulls the backpack out of the way. The woman says, "Now, are you ahead of me? Do you know where this is going?"
Thanks.
Flowery introduction from the front of the room. "I now introduce to you Chief Medical Examiner of the State of Virginia." This woman gets up and walks to the front. My colleague was more rude than I was, but I don't know that he was wrong. He began to kick the chair in front of him. And he says to the girl, "Aren't you ashamed? Aren't you feeling bad?" This moment when you suddenly realize you have mistaken, you've missed an opportunity for something special by the way you've done that. Okay? The word accosted in at least one translation suggests that there's a hint in the Hebrew that the initial interaction was one that Saul might very well wish he could take back and start over. And I just suggest to that was a beautiful moment to actually watch that student as my friend kicked her chair. Aren't you ashamed? Yes.
Just a quick comment. When we started this thing off, you said now the donkeys are, since the donkeys are missing. This is so typical of Africa when we live there. I can remember being out in a village and a man came to me and said, my donkeys were lost last month. And there was a prophet in the village. Now, it's just like it's coming out of here. And the man prayed and told me where the donkeys were. And I'm out there as a missionary, and he said, "My donkeys have got lost again. Can you tell me where they are?" And my Western mind, I actually thought about it then, but even as I read this now, I'm sure we're out of tune a lot of times, too. This man was looking to me to tell him where his donkeys were. They were missing.
Everybody. How'd that go?
Donkeys for the, huh?
How did that go?
I said, "Hey, let me pray for you to find those donkeys. I can't tell you where they are, but God can." That's just kind of how I answered. We prayed for his donkeys, and I do not know how it turned out. But they do look for spiritual guidance in everything. And I think, even then, I probably missed the something. I kind of dismissed it as, there's no way I'm going to know where these donkeys are. And maybe there isn't. But it is true, God knew where those donkeys were. But when I read this and hear this story, it's like it was right there in Mopani, Botswana, this little village. Because this man was looking for somebody who had at least a spiritual title, who would probably be able to get in touch with God and see where those donkeys were. Anyway.
Let's pick up the story in verse 20. "Concerning your donkeys, however, which strayed 3 days ago, don't worry about them. They've been found." And then he adds this wonderful but strange language. Look at what he says. "And for whom is the whole wealth of Israel destined, if not for you and for the members of your father's family?" To this, Saul replied, what's his first reply? "Wait a minute, I'm a Benjamite. And Benjamin is the smallest tribe of all of Israel, and my father's family is the least of all the families that are in Benjamin. Why are you saying a thing like this to me?" This is your first clue. This is your first clue. Can you leap to the conclusion from this first clue? Saul has a problem. What's his problem? He has a pretty significant inferiority complex. If you are inferior, it's not a complex to think you are. Let me say that again. If you really are inferior, it's not a complex to think you are. But if you have capacity and you have ability and you don't believe it, there can be some pretty severe problems. I'm going to leap ahead probably 2 or 3 weeks of our working with this. Saul's inferiority complex makes him actually jump between two extremes. One extreme, I can do no wrong. The other extreme, I can do no right. He never seems to find any kind of middle ground. Right now, he's almost entirely on the side of, I've got nothing to offer, I've got nothing to do, and why is anybody thinking I should?
Is that from his father, you think? Maybe browbeating?
We are given no clues of that, at least none that I can find. But you can speculate all kinds of places where that could have come from.
Is he an only child, or do we know?
I don't think we know that. I do think this picture of him being head and shoulders taller than everybody else. I can remember sitting on some steps outside of the North Grounds Recreation Area at UVA with a graduate student that was there. And the graduate student was just saying, I don't even know why I'm here. I'm so different from everybody else. And I looked at him and I said, you know, you're right. But let's examine that thought for just a minute. And I started walking through all the people that were graduate students alongside of him and showing that each one of them, in his or her own way, was different from everybody else as well. That there is a uniqueness that we perceive as differences, and if we perceive the differences as debilitating, you're going to have some real problems. Far as I know, he had that one night where he had all kinds of trouble and all that sort of went back away. And he was very successful from there on and is today.
Do we have anything that says why Saul is chosen? Why Saul? I mean, I just sat down.
Verse 15 of chapter 9, the Lord had given Samuel a revelation. I'm sending to you a man from the tribe of Benjamin. He's the one that you're going to appoint. But there is no, that's all you have. That's all you have.
There's no indication what there was about it.
Yeah, something to watch for in the course of time. We'll talk about it when it comes up. But something to watch for. When all of this is over and Saul has lost his kingdom, Samuel goes into mourning for him. And there comes a point where God said, quit your mourning. That's over. You've got other work to do. It's very interesting. It sounds like Samuel is really harsh with him all the way through. But at the end, Samuel seems to really have quite a bit invested in him to the point where when Saul fails, Samuel grieves rather than lowers the hammer and sort of says, well, that's the right thing to do. He lowers the hammer, but it's also a sense of he then goes away privately and mourns to the point where God almost has to get him going again. I've given you
a... It sounds like he looked like a king to look.
He did that.
He was the most handsome man, head and shoulders and all that, but...
I want to make sure that you hear this. What has Samuel just told him? The people have asked for a king. God has said, give them a king. Chances are everybody knows that. That word would have spread like wildfire, right? And Samuel is saying, you're the one that God has selected. And that's right, God has selected him.
And though it's pretty obvious, it just sort of...
And yet, there seems to be a total lack of confidence in Saul to actually take on those functions. Okay? Now, if you come down to verse 22, there's something strange in here, and I'm going to give you the two ways that I know of to think about this. Samuel then took Saul and his servant, brought them into the hall, and gave them a place at the head of the guests, of whom there were about 30. Samuel then said, the cook served the portion which I gave you and told you to put on one side. My translation shows this in a negative light. Let me read it for you. The cook then picked up the leg and the tail, and put it in front of Saul, saying, this is for you. This is all that was left. Have a good meal. Now, there are other translations that seem to read that the choice portion had been set aside, maybe even a portion reserved for the priests, and that he was being given the best. I can't tell. My translation suggests that what he was given was something that might even confirm his own low opinion of himself. I can't tell. It certainly was a portion that was set aside.
What translation are you reading?
We'll talk about that later. But this translation gives a slightly different way of reading this. Okay? Slightly different way of reading this. And I offer you those two. It was either a choice portion or a very unchoice portion. It's hard to tell. More translations line up with what yours say. Fewer line up with this. But there is a suggestion there. Okay? Next day, verse 27, they're leaving town. They've had their conversation. Samuel says to Saul, "Tell your servant to go on ahead of us, but you stand still for a moment so I can make known to you the word of the Lord." Chapter 10, verse 1, what does Samuel do? Takes some oil. Keep going. Anoints him. And what does he say? "Has not the Lord anointed you as the leader of his people? You are the man who is to govern the Lord's people, and you are the man to save them from the power of the enemies surrounding them. The sign for you that the Lord has anointed you as a prince of his heritage is this." And he then gives him one, two, three things that are going to happen. Number one, verse 2, "After leaving me today, you will meet two men, and here's what's going to happen with them." Verse 3, "Going on from there, you will come to the oak of Tabor, where you will meet three men going up, and these things will happen." And then verse 5, "After this, you will come to Gibeah, where a Philistine garrison is, and when you're just outside the town, you'll meet a group of prophets, and the Spirit of the Lord is going to seize you, and you're going to go into ecstasy with those prophets." Sort of like an Episcopalian becoming a Pentecostal for a few minutes. That's going to happen to you. "You will then go on ahead of me." This is verse 8. Where? Chapter 10, verse 8. "You're going to go ahead of me." Where?
To Gilgal.
And he says, "I will join you there." Who's that? That's Samuel. "I will join you there." For what purpose? To make burnt offerings and communion sacrifices. And then the verse finishes with, "You must wait for me how long?"
7 days.
7 days. I want you to hang on real tight to that. That becomes very significant. "You wait 7 days for me to come to you, and I will then reveal to you what you must do." As soon as he has turned his back to leave Samuel, verse 9 says, God changed his heart. Was this a permanent change? The evidence of later chapters suggests it was not. And that's illustrative and probably instructive. Temporary versus permanent changes of heart is an issue. It says that all these signs occurred that very day, and at the end they came to Gibeah. A group of prophets came to meet him. The Spirit of God seized on him. He fell into ecstasy with them. And after they came out of ecstasy, this is verse 13, he went to Gibeah, into Gibeah, and his uncle found him and his servant. What did the uncle ask? I'm at verse 14, I think, of chapter 10. What did the uncle ask? "Where have you been?" Now, pause for a minute. Look up. Pause for a minute. What's the answer? Is that important anymore? He's been anointed to be king. Do the donkeys matter anymore? I'm sorry. He's been told the donkeys have been found, right? Do the donkeys matter anymore? Where have you been? What's the answer? I've been with Samuel. He anointed me to be king. That's the answer, right? Does he give that answer? What does he talk about? Talk about the donkeys. He does mention that he found the donkeys because they went to Samuel. Oh, what did Samuel say to you? He told us the donkeys were already found. And he says nothing else. Do you find this strange? Why? He didn't talk about the big thing. So why didn't he talk about the big thing? He doesn't want to happen. He doesn't want it. He is feeling inferior. That can't possibly be so. Maybe if I don't talk about it, it won't happen. Verse 17, Samuel summoned the people to the Lord where? Mizpah, not at Gilgal. This is not the Gilgal moment yet. Some of the people of the Lord to Mizpah, and he said to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of Israel, says this, I did all these things for you, and you don't care. You want a king, so today you're going to have a king. And he then said, take your positions before the Lord, tribe by tribe and clan by clan, and he starts to cast lots. And what happens as he's casting lots? The lots turn to Benjamin, then they turn to Kish's family, then they turn to Kish's little family group, and then they finally turn to Saul, and they look for Saul, and what happens? He's not to be found, God says. I think it's really interesting what comes next. They consulted the Lord. Is he here? And the Lord says, yeah, he's here. Where is he? See, here's this great crowd of people. You should be able to see him. He's head and shoulders taller than everybody. But instead, he's hiding in the baggage. Why is he hiding in the baggage? Because he doesn't want this to happen. I'm not worthy. I don't want it. Why are you trying to push this on me? Why would God have chosen a person like this? I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue. It seems strange.
To teach a lesson to the Israelites that maybe the human king...
I'd love to say that, but I don't think there's enough evidence here to say. It's just, it's very, very strange. They ran out and fetched him, and as he stood among the people, what do they notice? He looks like a king. He's head and shoulders taller than any of them. Samuel then said to all the people, you have seen the man whom the Lord has chosen, and that among the whole of the people he has no equal. And the people all acclaimed him, shouting, long live the king. Samuel then, this is verse 25, watch carefully in your translation, I need some help here. Samuel then explained the king's constitutional position to all the people, and inscribed this in a book which he placed before the Lord. They didn't have a constitution. That seems to be a strange term to use. What term do they use in yours?
Regulations,
yours says.
Rights and duties.
Rights and duties. Samuel then sent all the people away, everyone back to his home. Saul too went home to Gibeah, and with him went those strong men whom God's heart had touched. He now has an escort, a bodyguard, or a group that goes with him. But, verse 27 says, there were some, and I need your word. Yours says despicables. Yours says scoundrels. Troublemakers. Worthless. Okay? And what else? What do they say?
They can't help us.
Okay. Does anybody have the message, or can you get it easily?
How can this fellow save us?
I've got the new living. How can this man save us? And they despised him and refused to bring him presents.
Okay, there's a term I want to see if I can get. We got it in the first hour. It is verse 27, I think. There were some riffraff, I think, the message
yes.
uses. Is that right? Did you find the word riffraff?
Yeah.
Okay, read that for us.
Went off muttering.
Went off muttering. What were they muttering?
Deliverers don't make me laugh. They held him in contempt and refused to congratulate him.
They went away muttering. Deliverer? That one? Don't make me laugh.
Well, it seems like the only qualification, because he was different, was he was tall
and handsome.
They might have a point.
Yeah.
You know, back earlier it said when he was prophesying when the priest...
When he was in ecstasy.
Yeah, they said people were saying, could that be Saul? I mean, kind of like, he must have been a scoundrel or something. I mean, certainly not.
Well, he wasn't. He doesn't appear to have been thought of as well as his height might have made.
He didn't have charisma that we want in a leader.
Doesn't seem like it. Okay, now I'd like you to hold on to the thought that some people acclaimed him, some people's heart was touched and they followed him, but there were some who just dismissed him derisively and just put him down. Okay? There's some evidence, okay? But keep your eye on that, okay? All right. Chapter 11, some people from the Ammonites came in, laid siege to a particular city that was not too far away. The people of that city said, okay, we'll surrender. And the people who were besieging them said, okay, just make sure you know, we're going to put out your right eye and make you a joke in all of Israel. Mine says, make you a taunt in all of Israel. That was the end of verse 2. The elders of that city said, give us a few days to think about this. Sent word to Saul. Saul, in a very dramatic way, makes it clear, I'm expecting everybody to come or I will retaliate like crazy. He uses fear as a motivating factor. And he ends up with an army that's how big? You have to go a verse or two. Verse 8. Chapter 11, verse 8. How big is the army he gathers? He gathers an army of 300,000. Okay? He sends messengers back to the people of that city, tell them tomorrow help will reach you, so put them off that long. And they said to their besiegers, tomorrow you can do whatever you want to us, we'll come out. And the next day Saul came in and attacked and destroyed the besieging army. Verse 12. The people then said to Samuel, what did they say? Who was it who said, must we have Saul reigning over us? Hand those men over for us to put them to death. Who's that? Who are they talking about? They're not talking about the Ammonites. They're talking about that riffraff back up in 27. Okay? And what does Saul say? Remember, the people went to Samuel, right? But Saul's the one who speaks. What does he say? He's actually pretty gracious. Nobody's going to be put to death today. This is the day the Lord has intervened to rescue Israel. Samuel then said to the people, let us go down to Gilgal and reaffirm the monarchy there. Everybody went to Gilgal, and there at Gilgal they pronounced Saul king before the Lord, offered communing sacrifices before the Lord, and there Saul and all the people gave themselves over to great rejoicing. Now, I would like to propose that either the 7 days of waiting before Saul would meet Samuel at Gilgal hasn't happened yet, or it's going to happen twice. Do you notice there's no mention of waiting 7 days for Samuel to show up? Way back there, remember he said, go there to Gilgal, wait 7 days, I will come, we will offer sacrifices. I propose that that still has not happened yet. I propose that that still has not happened yet. Or if it has, so this is certainly at Gilgal, and they're certainly offering sacrifices. If they have, then it's going to happen again. Everybody still okay? Okay. Chapter 12.
Are you saying that, what about 11:3? Is that, did you refer to that? Where it said the elders, when they told them they were going to surrender, they said, give us 7 days so we can send a messenger throughout it.
Yeah, I don't think that's not Saul waiting for Samuel 7 days. There's a 7 day period in which Saul is gathering an army and attacking and driving off those who have been besieging them. I do not believe that's the same thing. If it is the same thing, then what I'm talking about is going to happen again. There's going to be a time, it's coming, when Samuel is late. 7 days have gone by, and Saul is waiting on him to show up, and he hasn't shown up. And when he gets there, he's supposed to do burnt offerings and sacrifices. That I do not believe that time has come yet. And I don't know how to reconcile it perfectly into the record that's here. I just suggest, even though they're at Gilgal and offering sacrifices, the time that he talked about has not yet come. Chapter 12, verses 1 through 5, Samuel is basically saying to the people, okay, you now have a king. That means you do not need me to any longer be a political leader. You do not need me to be a judge anymore. Samuel, remember, was both a judge and a prophet. He's basically saying, my time as a judge is ending. You now have a king, and you're going to have to be working with that king. So, as I end my service, I want to make sure that that if anyone has anything against me in the way I have functioned, I want to hear it now. And you can almost hear the words that come in some marriage ceremonies, or forever hold your peace. Okay? His sons, remember, were scoundrels, and people had all kinds of things against them. Samuel is sort of clearing the line. If anybody's got anything against me, now's the time to say it. And nobody does. Verse 6 down to verse 11, Samuel reminds the people of all that God has done and of all the things they've done that put them into agony and put them into terror. And then verse 12 is the place where it hints that the reason the elders came to ask for a king wasn't the behavior of Samuel's sons as much as it was something else. Do you read chapter 12, verse 12, to suggest that there was a different reason they asked for a king? Look at chapter 12, verse 12. When you saw Nahash, king of the Ammonites, marching on you, you said to me, we must have a king to rule us. Back in chapter 8, it was, your sons are scoundrels and they're not doing the right things. We need a king so that there'll be somebody to rule us who isn't corrupt. Now they're saying there was another reason, and that was this invading army. Let me keep reading. The Lord your God is your king, but you still wanted the king to rule us. So here's the king you've chosen. Samuel is still in his transfer of power moment. The Lord has appointed you a king. If you fear and serve the Lord and obey his voice and do not rebel against his commands, if both you and your king, the king who rules you, follow the Lord your God, all will be well. But if you don't, disaster is coming and the Lord's hand will be against you. And then he brings a sign which appears to have to do with weather. You have the sense that this was a country with dry seasons and wet seasons, and he makes it rain and thunder in the middle of a time when it never rains and thunders. He says to the people in verse 20, don't be afraid, you have done wicked things, but do not withdraw your allegiance from the Lord. Instead, serve him with all your heart. And the Lord, for the sake of his great name, will not desert his people. It has pleased the Lord to make you his people. And then verse 23 is very, very illuminating as to the heart of Samuel. I'm no longer going to be your judge. I'm no longer going to be the one who's ruling you politically. But what does he say in verse 23? He states it with a sort of an Eastern twist to it. Far be it from me to sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you or by ceasing to instruct you in what is the good and the right way. Fear no one but the Lord. Serve him faithfully with all your heart. And if you don't, disaster is coming. The picture you have is that Samuel says, I will continue to be a spiritual leader, but I will no longer be a political leader. And I will continue to pray for you. So far, so good? Everybody all right? Chapter 13. I think I want to start with chapter 13, verse 19. I waited a little bit longer in the first hour to get to this verse, and I think I want to get to this verse right now. Before you even start chapter 13, what do you see? Chapter 13, verse 19, what does it say? There was no blacksmith anywhere in the territory of Israel. Why not? The Philistine says if we allow blacksmiths in there, you're going to make armaments for war. So instead, it says the people of Israel were in the habit of going individually down into the land of the Philistines to get their implements of agriculture sharpened. Is that the way yours says it?
Something like
that. Mine says plowshares. Right? Axes. Mattocks. And scythes. I asked in the first hour if anybody knows what a mattock is, and several of them did. One guy said, in particular, I've been on the wrong end of a mattock more times than I can count, and I don't ever intend to be there again, which I thought was interesting. He says that a mattock is something that has one blade going forward that's wide and flat, and another blade coming back that is this way. And you use this one to break up the ground, and then you use the other one like a hoe to sort of dig holes and stuff like that. Scythe is usually a curved thing used to cut grain. Axe makes sense. You chop down trees and so forth with that. You can certainly use axes and mattocks as implements of war if you want to, but they're nowhere near as good as a sword or a spear. And if you keep reading, it tells you something very interesting. Verse 22, on the day that they went to battle, how many people had a sword? How many people had a spear? It isn't none. It says no one except. There is an except down there. Saul and Jonathan. Who was Jonathan? Saul's son. They haven't bothered to tell you that. The writer has not made that clear yet. But Jonathan was his son. Okay, now jump back to verse 3. Sorry, jump back to verse 2. Saul sends most of the people home. That's at the end of verse 2. Early part of verse 2, it tells you how many he kept. He keeps a small force, about how many people?
3,000.
3,000. Separated or divided up how? 2,000 with Saul, 1,000 with Jonathan. Verse 3, what does Jonathan do? Yours says attacks, mine says killed the Philistine governor stationed at Gibeah. Gibeah, you may remember, was mentioned as an outpost for the Philistines. There's a Philistine governor at that point. Jonathan killed him. The Philistines were informed that the Hebrews had risen in revolt. Saul had the trumpet sounded throughout the country. Verse 4, and all of Israel heard the news. Quote Mark. What's the news they heard?
Saul.
Who did it?
Saul.
Oh, let's back up. Who did it?
Jonathan.
What are the people here?
Saul
did it. I don't know if that's a clue or not, but there's a point that comes much, much later with David where a little song was sung. David at that point had killed one person, but what was the song? Saul has killed his thousands. David has killed his tens of thousands, and Saul got mad as the dickens at somebody else taking credit for something more than he's done. I don't know if that was in hiding in here or not, but there's a hint, if you know what's coming, that it might be. Verse 5, the Philistines mustered to make war on Israel. What did they bring to the battlefield? How many chariots? 3,000, right? How big is the army that Saul has left? How big is the army that Saul had left? 2,000 with him, 1,000 with Jonathan, and they're coming with 3,000 chariots. Mine says 6,000 horse. What does that mean?
Mine says 30,000.
Does it now? How interesting.
30,000.
Yes, there is a variation in one of the Hebrew record that says 30,000. How many horse? Horse, I think, means cavalry. How many are they bringing of those? 6,000 mounted horsemen. Cavalry, right?
Mine says charioteers.
Yeah, the people that ride the chariot.
That would be two men.
What does say soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore?
Yeah, I was getting to that. When you get to the infantry, you can't count them. So your translation suggests 3,000 chariots with two men per chariot. That might be what it means, in which case if there's 30,000, then there's 60,000. You got 3,000 in your army. You've got 2,000 with you. The other's got 1,000 with them. You're looking, and the chariots equal you in number. What's your reaction? Verse 6, when the Israelites saw that their plight was desperate, being so hard pressed, the people hid in. And I want to know how many words you have there.
Caves
is your first word. What's your second word? Thickets. Mine says holes. Third?
Rocks.
Mine says crevices. What's the fourth one?
Pits.
Pits. Mine says vaults.
Sisters.
Fifth one?
Sisters.
Mine says wells.
Tunnels.
Yours says tunnels somewhere there. Okay? Everywhere you can find a place to hide, they're hiding. Okay? They're running like rabbits and they're hiding like rabbits. We saw a bunny rabbit last night.
Some even crossed the Jordan.
Some even crossed the fords of the Jordan into the next territory over. Verse 8, Saul was still at Gilgal and all the people who followed him were trembling. Pause. That's the tail end of verse 7, I think. Is that right?
Yes.
Where was Saul?
Gilgal.
Who's with him? About 2,000 troops. Maybe if Jonathan's troops are back with him, it's 3,000 troops. And what are the people doing? Mine says trembling. Yours says quaking in fear. So far, okay? Where is he?
Gilgal.
Huh. Verse 8, how long did he wait? I think this is the moment that they were talking about way back then.
Well, he says it's time set by Samuel is what mine says.
That's even better. I hadn't spotted that translation.
What was that?
Samuel, he says the time set by Samuel. I'm trying to get you to see way back early, I think that Samuel was setting a time, but I hadn't seen that translation to confirm that. And what it said was, you're going to wait for me 7 days. You've got an army of numbers that are overwhelming, right? And you are sitting there with 3,000 troops to fight against them. and you're waiting on Samuel to show up and make an offering. And the first day goes by, and they could attack at any moment. And the second day goes by, what would the fourth day have felt like? What would the fifth day have felt like? Is there anything like this in the Old Testament? Say yes.
Yeah.
How many people in the Old Testament are named as having leprosy? Two. As far as I know, two. One is Miriam, who had it briefly as a punishment from God because she was fighting against Moses' leadership. And who's the other one?
The general
from Syria named Naaman, whose little servant girl said, "Would that my master would go. There's a prophet in Israel who can cure him." Who's that prophet?
Elisha,
I think, but it's one of the two. It's one of the two, and we'll just agree on that, right? Okay, you remember that? That general got so mad. I thought he would come out. I thought he would put his hand on me, call on his God, do all these. He didn't even come out to see me. He just sent me word. What was he supposed to do? Go and wash yourself, dip yourself in the Jordan River seven times. We've got beautiful rivers in Damascus. Why would I crawl into this mud-infested place? And some of his aides said, if the prophet had asked you to do some great thing, wouldn't you have done it? He asked you to do something minuscule. Why are you resisting? Now, I have a picture. I don't know that it's right, but my picture is that he had to dip once a day for 7 days. The sixth day of taking off all his robes and walking probably naked down into this thing in front of all of his soldiers, and nothing happened. That waiting would have been a long time, right? I think something like that is happening here. Here's Saul waiting and waiting and waiting. And finally, the morning of the seventh day comes, and he says, "I can't wait any longer," and he offers the burnt offering. And the moment he finishes up, Samuel comes walking up, and Samuel says, and I don't know which way to say it, he either says, "What are you doing?" Or he says, I'm looking at verse 11, "What have you been doing?" And Samuel responds with excuses. "I saw my army deserting." If you get to verse 15, you'll find his army of 3,000 is down to 600. "I saw my army deserting me, and I saw that you had not come at the time fixed, and I saw the Philistines mustering, so I thought the Philistines are going to fall on me at Gilgal, and I haven't implored the favor of the Lord, so I felt obligated to make a burnt offering myself." And Samuel says, "You've acted like a fool, and God is going to take your kingship away." Now, I've got very little time to say this. If you look through the whole of the Old Testament, you find over and over again, God pronounces a disaster on a people, but it doesn't always come about. The spectacular example is Jonah. Jonah goes to Nineveh and preaches God's wrath and God's judgment, and the people of Nineveh repent. And God doesn't do it. You remember what Jonah said? Jonah says, "I knew you would do that. I knew you were a God of compassion. How dare you not destroy this awful people?" Okay, you remember that? It is my belief that at this moment, God has condemned Saul, but he has done so conditionally. And I believe if Saul had repented and had returned, that this would have been taken away. And I say that because there's going to be something coming next week where the condemnation is finally affirmed. And I think there was a window here where the judgment had been pronounced, but it was conditional on Saul's response, and Saul has not responded well. I commend that to you for reading. This is as far as we can go right now. Let's have a word of prayer before we finish. Our Father, we see today a deeply flawed person chosen by you for leadership who collapses or seems to collapse under that responsibility. We start to recognize we sometimes see some of ourselves in that. So today we pray that you would give your spirit the ability within each one of us to bring your thoughts, your guidance clearly into view, and that we would have the good sense to listen and act. We start to recognize you're giving us very important guidance here. the Lord loves obedience much more than he loves ritual. And we're watching for that. We pray today for our church and for the leaders of this church. We pray for ourselves when we are in leadership positions that we would be the kinds of leaders that you are asking us to be. We pray all this in your Son's name. Amen.